Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me here today, where we seek to reconnect the eternal with the everyday. We bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news in order that each of us and all of us can be prepared and equipped to enter into the conversations of our day in ways that honor Jesus. And so it would be impossible, again, today, for me to avoid at least touching on the Kavanaugh nomination process. That's just sort of an ongoing, fairly disgusting, unraveling expose. I don't really know what else to call it. And so I'm going to approach it today in this particular way. And I'm just going to do this for a couple of minutes here at the outset, because I do think it is the dominating conversation in our culture. I wish we were talking about what's happening at the UN or something else, but culturally, this is the subject matter of the day. And so I want to at least have us be equipped to engage in it, not avoid it. I would like to avoid this conversation as much as you. It's certainly not a conversation that I want to have with my kids. So here's the way I'm going to approach it. You have very likely not only heard ongoing accusations, and we're going to use that term at this point, uncorroborated accusations against an individual whose name is Brett Kavanaugh. We also have in the Star Tribune today another article about Keith Ellison and his ex-girlfriend and her allegations of abuse during their relationship. So the reason that I want to juxtapose these two stories is because I do think that it gives us the opportunity to evaluate whether or not we are willing to believe something bad about someone because we do or do not, I guess probably because we do not agree with them on some sort of political agenda. So are you more likely to believe the accusation against Brett Kavanaugh? Are you more likely to believe the accusation against Keith Ellison because your politics line up with one of them or the other? That's sort of the evaluative question I want us as Christians to ask ourselves today, because that's a serious hypocrisy question. That's a stand in the mirror kind of question. And so I think that's a relevant question for us as Christians to ask today. I also think that it's important in a time when a person's story, the truth that they are representing, the narrative that they are representing, is expected to be believed without any corroborating evidence, I think that's an interesting day and time in which to live. And so I want to talk about truth, and I want to talk about reality and the necessity of both of those things being in alignment with one another. If we're actually going to not only function as a society, but if we are going to function in an honest relationship with God. So what is truth and how do we discern it? That's where I want to start the conversation today. What is truth and how do we discern it? Is it true that, I don't know, pick something that we sort of all know is true. Is it true that things fall down, they don't fall up? Yes, that's true. Is it true that the earth rotates on what we think of as its axis? Yes, that's true. If the earth were to stand still, things would go flying about in horrible ways. So now, is it true that the earth is a big magnet? Well, that's a sort of different conversation, right? And how would we discern the answer to that question? Is it true that people are biologically overwhelmingly here? Now, I'm not going to get into the very small percentage of people about whom this would not be true. But let's just say, you know, if we were going to just talk biology, is it true that biologically people are either male or female? Yeah, I mean, it's true. And yet we actually have those today at the university level who argue that that kind of biology or that kind of biological binary should not be taught because it's not true for everyone. Now, just think about that, that a biology professor is not really allowed to teach that there's a biological binary between male and female human beings, because that biological reality does not align with the self-perception of some people who do not see themselves, for whom their truth is not a binary sexual reality. So we are inviting the culture to enter into the delusion of those for whom truth does not align with reality. And that's the conversation that we as Christians have to constantly be having. If it's truth, then it aligns with reality. And when we talk about reality, we have to talk about what really is. So I think that there are lots of folks. In fact, let me phrase it this way. Just because virtually everyone wants to believe something about someone, good or bad, just because virtually everyone wants to believe something about someone, good or bad, does not in fact make it true. If, and that's a big if truth is understood as that which accords with reality, then you can't have your truth and it be something different than quote unquote my truth. If truth is truth, then it's true for you and it's true for me. And the whole idea that my truth or my narrative or a story which defines and explains me and my behavior, if that is our definition of truth now in the culture in which we live, then we have descended into what Lewis Carroll described very vividly as Alice's Wonderland. So let's talk about how we know what we know. So this is a conversation about epistemology. I know that when we do conversational apologetics, I actually try to avoid the big fancy words. But the reality is you kind of have to know some of the propositional apologetics in order to be a really good conversational apologist. And so every single day, one of the things that I'm trying to do is equip you as a conversational apologist. That's actually how I view what I'm doing here. I'm trying to equip you to go out and actually enter into conversations with real people about the real things that are being talked about in the real world. And so we take the headline news, and then when I say we bring the mind of Christ to bear, what I'm really talking about is putting all the tools of propositional apologetics to work in order to produce some conversational ways in which you and I can help others see reality for what it really is. So general revelation is a part of epistemology, the way we know what we know. And the Bible is really clear that there's enough evidence in general revelation, in creation itself, for people to actually recognize the reality that there is a God. Now, not to know him personally, because you can't know someone personally until you've actually met them. But there's enough evidence revealed in creation itself, this general revelation revealed to everyone, for people to, as Scripture says, be without excuse in terms of acknowledging the reality of a God. You might think of it as a divine designer, the one who we recognize made all things, but at least everyone could agree, the one who conceived all things. Okay, so general revelation, the facts on the ground that everyone can apprehend with the five senses. We're talking here about empirical evidence about reality that's available to everyone. And then there's something we call special revelation. Okay, and this is these are the things that are revealed by God to us. Not generally through creation, but through God's special revelation of himself. And God's revelation of himself, and therefore his will and his character, in the context of human history, we receive through the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And we know the fullness of God's revelation in the person of Jesus Christ. And so when we talk about special revelation, we're talking about those ways in which God has specially revealed not only himself, but the truth about everything. And so if you want to know the underlying truth about creation, you can find it actually through scientific inquiry, because there's enough evidence in creation itself that bears witness to God to come to the conclusion that all of this could not have sprung up on its own. There must be a designer behind it all. Or you can actually read what God has revealed about creation in the Old and New Testaments of the Bible. Fast forward. How do we know who we are, and how do we know then what we're on earth here to do? Those questions are actually answered through God's revelation in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. And so we are led to truth and set free by truth and follow the truth in actually knowing Jesus. And so I'm not saying that that people can't have some knowledge of the truth without Jesus, because obviously there's enough evidence in general creation. There's enough general revelation for people to actually be without excuse. However, God has by grace given us so much more than that, and we can know so much more than that, and we do know so much more than that if we are in Christ. And so I want to encourage you today to be a person of truth, right? We are disciples of the one who is the way and the truth and the life. He leads us into all truth by the power of the Holy Spirit. We are truth tellers. We're invited to speak the truth, or commanded to speak the truth always in all ways, and to do so in ways that honor Jesus. So that's what I want to encourage you to do today. Be a person whose standard of evidence is not only that empirical evidence, but also that evidence that comes by knowing who God is and why he made us and how he has redeemed us and what he has in mind for us in this world. All right, friends, next up, I'm going to have a conversation with Denise Schick. So I read a couple of headlines yesterday related to what's going on in California and children as young as 12 and 13 receiving transgender treatment without parental consent. Denise Schick came to mind. She's a person I have conversed with in the past, and she has written a piece in The Federalist about what's going on in California, and she is going to be here with us to talk about that here on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me now is Denise Schick. She is engaged with an organization called Help for Families. And you put the number four in there, help4families.org. You can also engage with them on Facebook, Help for Families. Denise, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So if it's okay with you, let's start by establishing why I'm having this conversation about children and transgenderism, why I'm having this conversation with you.
Well, it's all in regards to the recent bill that was passed here in California that is allowing 12-year-olds to have a text-paid transgender treatment. We're talking about children at 12 years old. And so that really concerns me. As a child growing up in this kind of a confusing environment with a dad that identified as a woman, I know by 12 years old the confusion that I was in about my own identity. And so I think about if I would have made the decision back then as a child, as I pursued and pretended for a period of time of being a man, the disaster that would have occurred for my life. And I think that's what we're going to see in the future here with these young children. They're not mature enough to make such a decision about their life and the treatments and the consequences of this.
Well, and I love that your article at The Federalist gets to that point about maturity pretty quickly. That's actually the issue, the concern that you raise, and I think that's the right one. I want to read people your opening paragraph because I think it really stimulates the conversation. You say you have to be 16 to obtain a driver's license in California, 18 to buy a rifle, engage in consensual sex, or get married without parental consent, at 21 to buy a handgun, alcohol, or marijuana. But in the nation's most progressive state, you only need to be 12 years old to privately seek and consent to treatment for gender transitioning. Tell folks what's covered in this California law.
In the law itself, if a child is in foster care and comes to the parents and believes that they need to have that they are transgender, by law now, the foster parents would have to go along with this and seek treatment, seek what the child, you know, believes is best for them. And at that time, again, when we're looking at 12 years old, what are they really capable of understanding? This is a life-altering decision here. And that's just taking the rights away from parents, in a sense, fostering adults, making good, healthy decisions for a child who, again, their brain hasn't fully developed. And they're already, you know, struggling more than likely with wanting to be part of peer groups, be accepted, possibly have some issues with their own body and the way it's developing. Some young people feel awkward about that. And so there's different issues here that could tend somebody to take the wrong turn. And it just blows my mind that we are allowing children, you know, 12 years old, to make these kind of decisions where an adult, a mature adult, is not able to say this is not the best decision, you know, at this age.
So,
and
Denise,
one
of the things that I think is alarming to me and really difficult for me to comprehend, these are not, these are children whom we would not expect to be able to be held responsible in a court of law for their own moral or immoral decisions. I mean, we've reached the stage of the game here in what I view as sort of culture-wide delusion on this conversation about transgenderism, that we're saying that we're not only going to participate in the delusion, we're going to go so far as to sort of aid, advise, and even pay for, as taxpayers, what's called gender-affirming treatments, but I would call them, you know, gender reassignment treatments, or I would even go so far as to say, you know, we're talking about the mutilation of the flesh, and we're talking about having doctors and others participate in this instead of actually taking care of children who are suffering from body dysmorphia. I mean, am I wrong? Am I seeing it incorrectly? Help
no.
me out.
You're seeing it right on. And so the concerns that we ought to be addressing is how many of these children have a body dysphoria, whatever, you know, root issues, whatever they're really struggling with, and any psychological issues that may be underlining as well. What's going to happen when we've got 12 to 14-year-olds that can make this decision? And let's say, you know, then they're 35, 40. We've got a high suicide rate of 40% that attempt suicide now. Now, 20% of this population, unfortunately, are successful in those attempts of suicide. So my fear is that we are going to see a rise in this when then we have children now transitioning and adults later on that are going to be really unhappy and dissatisfied and depressed and full of life with anxiety in it.
Hmm. So some of our listeners may not know that actually in California, there are doctors performing full mastectomies on girls as young as 13. Do you have any information on what's going on there? I know I'm kind of surprising you with that question. That's sort of been on my mind as I've read it in the headlines.
I've heard from a family that had a daughter that was 14 years old, where this was was actually referred from the doctor for her to have a double mastectomy. And she had a lot of uncomfortableness about her body maturing into a young woman. So, you know, it's not going to stop there. So, you know, a double mastectomy, what happens then? She's still a female inside. And so to be able to have a piece of who you are and your biological makeup, this is why we've got to take care of where we are emotionally, you know, where are these children maturity? What is the reason for it? We also see where there's a rapid onset of gender dysphoria that was recently reported in the Brown University. And that was, you know, that showed alone the media, the power of the media and peers in schools where this is celebrated. This is something where you can be approved of living. And if you're looking for a place to belong, then this is going to be, sadly, a place where some will find when they don't feel like they fit in.
All right. So if you are listening to Connecting Faith right now, this is Carmen LaBurge, and I'm having a conversation with Denise Schick. We are talking about not only the development of these conversations in California, where state law now, I don't know, is the word requires, maybe it's enables, allows 12-year-olds to get taxpayer-funded gender or transgender treatments. But we're also talking about the range of concerns about adolescents and their ability to make decisions, the reality that they often change their minds later in life, and the sort of cultural pressure that exists right now, at least in some cultural subgroups, to move in this direction in terms of identifying as a transgender person, even though that's at the deepest of levels, not really what's going on, but that it's what's going on in your group, and you want to be a part of the group, and therefore you sort of say that this is who you are, and therefore what you want to do. Denise, would it be fair to say that we don't actually know what the long-term effects might be of giving girls of this age and boys of this age the kind of hormone blockers that we're talking about when we're talking about gender disrupting a person's puberty? I mean, we don't actually know. We're talking about permanent sterilization in some cases, are we not?
Mm-hmm. We are. And a great resource for people to know would be the American College of Pediatricians, you know, where they have been a great outspoken person against this type of child abuse, which is exactly what it is. We know that cross hormones are dangerous and that there is a risk that would include, for instance, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers. So, again, you know, we're encouraging our young people to be injecting synthetic drugs into their body that though they might morph on the outside, they're still biologically male or female, but there's going to be consequences to those. For those that were, I'm going to say, late teens, middle 20s that have transitioned and have talked with me, the difficulties that they've had where they've continued well into adulthood with depression, anxiety, and so they are still consistent on other type of prescription drugs to help them to deal with life.
Mm. All right, friends, if you want more from Denise, you can go to Help for Families. That's the number 4 in the middle of that, Help for Families. .org. Hey, Denise, in the minute we have left, I would love for you to just speak directly to people out there like yourself who have had a parent who has transitioned, and just speak to them in a ministry tone for a moment, because I know that is your calling and your gifting.
If you are, you know, if you've got a family member or a loved one, you are a loved one that struggles with this, just to know the power of God, the love that God has for you. And no matter which side of this journey that you're on, that he does not leave us alone in this, that he's with us. He gives us comfort, but he gives us wisdom. And for somebody that's struggling with this, to understand that he wants to be there for you through some healing that he alone, you know, can bring, and to have others to come alongside of you that understand what you're going through, but will lovingly, in a godly way, support you as well. And for family members, not to give up. You keep praying. You keep praying for that loved one. That's the one most powerful tool that you have in your hands.
Hey, Denise Schick, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith. Friends, if you're listening, when I come back, we're going to be talking with our friend Matthew Sorens from World Relief about the status of immigration and refugees. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined with one of my favorite conversation partners. His name is Matthew Sorens. You can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Sorens. He's the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. You can follow them on Twitter at World Relief. He's also the National Coordinator for the Evangelical Immigration Table and the co-author of Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. He has joined us in May and in June, and he is back now to, I think we're going to have an extended conversation today about all things immigration and refugees. So, Matthew Sorens, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you, Carmen.
So, I kind of stalk you on Twitter, and so I know that you have a personal connection to a New York Times story that just came out a couple of days ago about Nicaraguan migrants to Costa Rica. Tell us about your personal connection to that story.
Yeah, you know, I actually got a text from my brother who is out in Seattle that said, "Do you see the article about La Carpio in the New York Times?" So La Carpio is this neighborhood in San Jose, Costa Rica, that is primarily home to Nicaraguan immigrants, or at least in their families. So my two brothers and I spent a summer there when I was in college in 2003. working with a Christian ministry called Christ for the City, basically, you know, playing soccer with kids and leading Bible studies in what at the time was fairly broken Spanish. But, you know, it was a short-term mission sort of thing. But that, for me, was really the first time I started thinking about immigration. I didn't necessarily think about it growing up in Wisconsin, where, you know, I lived in a fairly ethnically homogenous community where immigration just wasn't much of an issue locally, and it was maybe a big national political issue that you heard about, but not something I thought about personally or thought about as a Christian. And for me, it was living in San Jose, serving Nicaraguan immigrants who were in many cases not treated particularly well by some people in San Jose, and who were blamed for a lot of the social problems or health issues, or, you know, they were simultaneously, I would hear that they were lazy or they were stealing jobs, which I never knew quite how to put those two pieces together. But, you know, that was where I started really wrestling with this and thinking through how do I respond to this issue of immigration in my context in the U.S. as a Christian? And unfortunately, La Carpio is in the news again because the situation politically in Nicaragua is very, very dire right now. I've been receiving all sorts of messages from friends there about just how badly it's gotten with violence from the government. And that's fueling a lot of people to leave Nicaragua once again. And many of them are going south to Costa Rica and landing with relatives or extended, you know, friends of friends in that neighborhood in San Jose, where there's a longstanding Nicaraguan community.
So one of the things that occurs to me as you tell this story is every time that we as evangelical Christians prepare to send high school and college students abroad for short-term mission trips, where, you know, we imagine that God is going to touch their hearts, God is going to do great work, and they very well may come home with a heart that is changed on issues of justice, issues of immigration, issues like the ones that we're talking about today. And so I think that as our listeners across the upper Midwest on the Faith Radio Network and those who are listening to us around the world via the Faith Radio app, you know, this is like Matthew's actually really an incredible testimony of the power of short-term mission trips, but then also, you know, the reality that God may do in a heart and mind something surprising. And we need to be ready as the church in North America to respond when God changes a heart and then sends us back a very young leader, as I believe God has done, you know, embodied in you. So, Matthew, let's talk about this immigration proposal. A lot of us have read about it in the news. I'm going to just use the phrase public charge rule, and then you're going to explain to us what's going on.
Yeah, so the public charge rule, and it's hard to explain simply because it is just so complex. It was a 400-page regulation that was proposed earlier this week. Basically, it's been in U.S. immigration law for more than a century that you are ineligible for permanent legal status and for some other immigration benefits if you are likely to become a public charge, which generically means you're going to end up relying on the state financially. You're not going to be economically self-sufficient. That's, again, been on the books for a really long time, going back to the Ellis Island era, where it was one of our first restrictions on immigration. The challenge with it is it's not necessarily been very specifically defined, at least not in the law itself. So at least going back to the 90s, the way that that's been interpreted by the immigration service of our federal government is that if you were likely to be primarily reliant on cash benefits, then you would be excluded. So it's always been a risk for some immigrants, and there's also some exceptions under the law, like for refugees. But for most immigrants, for example, if you've got a family sponsor petitioning for you, your family member has to be legally responsible for you financially and has to show that they're above a certain income level or that they have a co-sponsor who's above a certain income level, or you can't come to the United States. So that's been the law. That's been the way the law has been interpreted for a long time. What this new regulation, which is at this point just a proposal, it's not yet in place, it basically significantly broadens the definition of who could be a public charge or who could be likely to become a public charge to include some non-cash benefits like food stamps, which in the past haven't been a factor for consideration. And to be clear, not all immigrants qualify for food stamps. For example, if you are a family, if you are not here lawfully, you don't qualify for food stamps. Like you just can't. You can't go to the public aid office and request it. They won't give it to you. But there are categories of immigrants who actually do qualify, but for whom using those benefits for which they qualify could then make them ineligible to adjust status to permanent legal status. So if you're in a temporary status of some sort. So we'll see where this goes, but I think our concern at World Relief is it's actually already having an impact of scaring people who do qualify for those benefits, who are working, who are paying taxes, but who might qualify for something like food stamps. who it's already scaring people where they don't want to use those benefits because they're afraid it could affect their immigration benefits in the future. And in my view, it seems to be part of an overall effort to restrict legal migration. It's expected, and I think it's part of the intention here, that fewer people will qualify to come lawfully to the United States with this regulation if it goes into place. And my concern has always been the more difficult we make legal migration, especially at a time when we have very low unemployment rates and we have a lot of job needs in our country, the more we will see illegal immigration because people are mostly responding to economic incentives. If there's a job to be had and they can't come lawfully, people will often find a way to overstay a temporary visa or to cross the border unlawfully. And this is just another step towards restricting who can come lawfully because, again, not because they even necessarily have used public benefits, but because an officer of the government with a lot of discretion thinks, for example, because you're a large family, you're likely to at some point in the future.
Okay, friends, let me tell you that if you go and get the book, Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, you're going to have a depth and breadth of understanding of the history of the policies of, and practices of immigration here in the United States that's necessary. It's necessary that we actually understand where we've been and how we got here in order that we might actually find a way forward together. There's no one who thinks that the immigration way it works now works well. Everybody recognizes that it's broken, and we have to find a way to fix our legal immigration system. And yes, as soon as I say that, I know I'm going to have people tweeting and calling and texting about open borders. And the reality is that's not what we're talking about. We all recognize the need for secure borders. But what I hope you hear Matthew saying is unless our legal immigration processes are fixed and work and people can get green cards and they can work here legally. If we don't fix those processes in ways that actually help people flourish, then we are actually contributing to the ongoing influx of people arriving illegally. Okay, so let's talk about the real numbers because I haven't talked to you, I don't think, since these numbers came out about the numbers of refugees in the first 6 months of 2018. These numbers are pretty staggering. In the first half of 2018, we only admitted 23 Middle Eastern Christian refugees into the United States. If a group of people was ever identified as, you know, hey, these are the people that we want to be helping, it seems like Christians who are being persecuted around the world have at least been identified as a priority. Tell us what's going on in terms of actually who's arriving and what's going on with refugees right now.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of Americans are aware, maybe vaguely, that there's been restrictions on the U.S. refugee program, and especially that that's impacting Muslim refugees. And that is absolutely true. Muslim refugees who, in the last several years, have been somewhere between around 40% of all refugees coming to the United States, so actually fewer in most years than the number of Christians, but, you know, a significant number. Their numbers coming in the last, in 2018, and this is data I pulled a couple weeks ago, are down by about 91%. So literally it was, you know, 2016, 2 years ago, we had about 30,000 Muslim refugees into the country at this point in the calendar year. At this point, in 2018, we have about 2,400. So it's really a dramatic reduction. And again, we've been outspoken at World Relief that we don't think we should be keeping Muslim refugees out. We think that, you know, first of all, we believe in religious freedom. So to have the state deciding that one particular religious group should be excluded, or at least most of those people, is problematic. But also we believe every person is made in God's image and has inherent dignity and their lives are worth protecting. So we've been quite clear on that. But I think in some ways that's not surprising to people, given some of the campaign rhetoric before the election. What I do think is surprising to people and is a largely untold story is that persecuted Christians are also being kept out of the refugee program. Not at the same level as Muslims, but the number comparing 2016 to 2018 is down by about 60% of Christians from all countries. And then if you look specifically, as you alluded to countries where Christians face the worst persecution, which many of them are in the Middle East, the numbers are down 90, 95, 99%, depending upon the country we're talking about. So, for example, from Iraq, it was not an insignificant number of Iraqi Christians. And when I say Christians, they were primarily Chaldean or Catholic Christians, some Protestants. But at this point in 2016, there have been about 1,000 Iraqi Christians allowed to the United States. At this point in 2018, there's been fewer than 20. So it's just a really dramatic decline from a country where our State Department says Christians are facing genocide from ISIS and from some other groups. And to be fair, it's also not only Christians. Yazidis, who are another religious minority, who are not tolerated by the terrorist groups that unfortunately are very strong in parts of Iraq. At this point in 2016, there had been about 285 Yazidi refugees admitted. This year, there's been two. So it's affecting people of different religious groups, but especially religious minorities, including Christians. That's true of Iran as well, where it's the government that is the primary persecutor that does not treat Christians or other religious minorities well. At this point, 2 years ago, we had about 1,600 Iranian refugees who were Christians. At this point, this year, we're down to five. So that's like a 99.7% decline. I actually there was a piece in FoxNews.com the other day from a couple, two young Iranian women, Christians, actually Pentecostals, who were resettled through World Relief Atlanta a number of years ago. And they wrote their story about just their experience of, I mean, they were literally in prison for 9 months in Iran. They were sentenced to death, but by a lot of prayer from people around the world and a lot of advocacy, they were released after about 9 months, and they escaped to Turkey. And then eventually, after going through the vetting process, they were admitted as refugees to the U.S. and actually welcomed by a team from a local church in Atlanta in partnership with World Relief Atlanta. And so they've been here a few years now, and they basically made the point in this piece they wrote for FoxNews.com that, you know, they probably wouldn't have been allowed in the United States had this happened in 2018, because with five Iranian Christians, the odds that they would have made it amongst so few slots would be very slim. And, you know, they appreciate all the language about we're going to support religious freedom in Iran and in other parts of the Middle East. I think we all affirm that. But it's fairly obvious that there's still not religious freedom in Iran or in Iraq or in certain other countries. These are some of the countries that Open Doors, which is a group that advocates for the persecuted church, says are countries where Christians face the most extreme persecution in the world. And until those countries are safe for Christians, I really strongly believe that the U.S. should continue to be a safe haven for those people, and that we're turning our back on some of the most vulnerable people in the world who are also brothers and sisters in Christ, who the U.S. has historically been a safe haven for, but it's basically not in any significant way today.
So we actually talked recently here on Connecting Faith with Helen Fisher of Open Doors about gendered persecution and the particular negative effects that persecution has in terms of the targeting of women and girls around the world and in countries where obviously conversion is illegal. And so I think that for those who listen to Connecting Faith regularly or on a regular basis, they are recognizing what it would mean for the two women who wrote the article that was posted on the FoxNews.com opinion section, acknowledging that Iran had sentenced them to death for being Christians, but that America, had welcomed them, and that they are praying that America will continue to welcome other grateful refugees like them. I think that folks who are listening right now, Matthew, are putting the pieces together and recognizing that as Christians, we have brothers and sisters around the world who need us to help. Say something to people who are listening who would say, well, but we can't help everybody. So just answer that question, because I know you hear it a lot.
No, we do hear that a lot. And of course, it's true. We can't help everybody. You know, it was true when Jesus said in the Gospels, the poor you will always have among you. But he wasn't saying, so don't bother trying, because there is something we can do. That's true as individuals, as churches, but it's also true for our country. And to the extent that we're a democracy where we can influence our government's decisions, we can insist that the U.S. should do our part. So at World Relief, we've never said the U.S. should take all the world's refugees. In fact, our sort of audacious advocacy campaign was that the U.S. might consider taking 1% of the world's refugees, because under the Obama administration, at most, we took 0.5%, and at present, we're taking less than 0.1% of the world's refugees. But when we do our relatively small share, first of all, it allows us to bring in some of the most vulnerable cases where in that second country that people have fled to, whether it's Turkey or Jordan or Kenya or Malaysia from Burma, wherever people have fled, there are people who remain vulnerable in that second country. For example, because of their Christian faith or because of a medical situation or for any number of reasons. So it allows us to to provide, in some cases, literally life-saving help to some of the most vulnerable cases. And then, really importantly, it also is it's a foreign policy tool. It allows us to leverage what we will do to persuade our allies to do more as well. So, for example, for a country like Jordan or Kenya, which have both taken just incredible numbers of people, and not because they invited them, but because they are pouring across the border from a conflict in neighboring country. You know, Syrians going into Jordan, or a decade ago or more, Iraqis going into Jordan, or people from Somalia or South Sudan or Eritrea or Ethiopia going into Kenya. We tell these countries, look, you need to not turn those people back because they will literally be killed. And most countries in the world have agreed, going back to the era after World War II, where most countries were pretty ashamed of the way we turned back Jewish people fleeing the early rumblings of the Holocaust. Most countries in the world have basically agreed we won't send people back to a situation where they'll be killed. But when you've taken in an incredible number of people, it's not always popular in domestic politics for those countries to keep taking more people. But the U.S. has historically basically leverage some of our credibility to say, we need you to keep taking those people, and we'll take some of the most vulnerable cases off your hands, some of the single moms, some of the people who have medical conditions that you really can't support there, but if we resettle them near a good children's hospital in the United States, could have life-saving treatment. And when we shrink back and say, as the United States, despite all of our resources, we're just going to do so much less, and it's a really dramatic shift. I mean, it was, of all refugees from all countries, 2016, we took about 96,000 refugees. This year in 2018, we're on track to take about 22,000. So it's, you know, more than 75% decline. When we shrink back so dramatically, we just have a lot less moral credibility to tell our allies, you just need to keep doing more, when they're taking far more than 100,000 people who've showed up at their border in a given year in some cases.
Okay, friends, we're going to have to leave it there with Matthew Sorens, but let me encourage you to follow him on Twitter, at Matthew Sorens. Follow World Relief on Twitter, at World Relief. Literally, the headlines are full right now of testimonies and stories. There's one at jacksonville.com about a young refugee, and I think it makes the argument about human dignity and pro-life and connects those conversations to the immigration and refugee conversation. And I think it's important for us as Christians to be on the forefront of these discussions. So, Matthew, thank you again for joining us. We look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you, Carmen. I always appreciate being on.
Thanks. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll make a quick connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Our connecting point today will be quick because my conversation with Matthew Sorens ran a little long. But we had a lot to cover, and I think that if you're looking for help understanding what's going on in the immigration and refugee conversations here in the United States and you want to approach it from an authentically Christian point of view, he's a good guy to turn to as a resource. He speaks in very measured tones. He's not inflammatory, and yet I think he's seriously concerned about the human dignity of every person around the world and what we as Christians here in the United States might be doing to affect their lives. Okay, so I don't know what you've been watching in terms of your social media and things going on with your friends, but I got a lot of friends who are living in places where the water is high and actually places where the water is still rising. So I know that I've shared with you the prayer concern about friends in Conway, South Carolina. Today, I'll share with you a prayer concern about friends in Georgetown, South Carolina. Georgetown's at the confluence of several rivers, and literally there's a wall of water now headed their way as all of Hurricane Florence's many saturated, dirty, now contaminated millions of gallons of water head toward that one little town. So they're expecting something like 8 to 10 feet of water to arrive. And so let's be praying for them. Let's be praying for people to be wise in evacuating in advance. And the cleanup has begun in many, many places. And as a person, I lived on Hilton Head in South Carolina. And so we were always sort of prepared to evacuate at a moment's notice. And so when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. We had a lot of people in our church who were very, their just hearts leapt out of their chests and they wanted to go immediately. And so we were actually there fairly early on. Every first stage of recovery is that you actually have to gut your house. You have to pull out all of your carpet and you have to take all of the tile and you got to get your house down to the studs. You got to pull down all the drywall. And I want you to imagine the process of hauling everything you own out of every shelf, off of every wall, out of every drawer, every piece of furniture, every scrap of floor covering, everything that was on the walls and the walls themselves, and dragging it to the curb. And when we arrived, we were very anxious to, get busy very quickly. And at the very first house that we went to, it became very apparent to me that the ministry in which we were going to engage was going to be so painful for the homeowner, because what seemed to us like just nasty, rotting pieces of carpet and drywall that was soaked through and covered with mud and, it's horrible. It's horrible. You've never mucked out a house that's been flooded, especially with the kind of contaminated water that we're talking about. You've just really never smelled quite the extent of things. And yet for her, the carpet was precious. The furniture was precious. Every piece was precious. And so what we learned very quickly was that we actually needed to stop and ask her as we walked out of the front door of her house. We need to stop and ask her, can I take this to the curb? And she would look at it, and 9 times out of 10, she recognized that it was not redeemable and that it needed to go to the curb. And so it went to the curb. But surprisingly, strange little things she chose to keep. And so I just want us to remember today that that process is now going on in North and South Carolina on a massive scale. Our friends in Houston know what it felt like. Actually, we've got a lot of friends in Wisconsin who know what that has felt like. And so I just want to leave us with this today. As you are considering, how much people can carry and the value of things and what matters to us most, I want you to say, a prayer of thanksgiving to God today for people who carry others out of burning buildings and carry people out of flood-swollen houses and carry people off of battlefields. And then I want you and I to begin thinking about what it looks like to actively prepare to be the kinds of people who can not only carry our own weight spiritually, but we could actually carry the weight of another person. I'm not strong enough right now physically to carry another person up a hill. I'm not. But I want to be. And so I guess I want to ask us that question. Do we want to be spiritually strong enough? Do we want to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling at the kind of level where we would have such a robust faith, where the strength of our faith would be so great that not only could we carry our own weight, but we might actually be able to shoulder the burden of another in a time of real crisis? I read about a minimalist who carries all of his earthly possessions in the equivalent of a carry-on bag. The article appeared alongside advertising for new storage units that were opening just off of the interstate. Those are extremes. So today's question is this: in what tangible way can I live more simply that someone else might simply live? Okay, hey, tonight, anybody watching PBS, the PBS Mayo Clinic documentary? It's on tonight. I want you to watch it because I want to talk about it. The Mayo Clinic is obviously an enormously influential clinic, service provider, employer, community agent of good throughout the upper Midwest and in Florida and in Arizona and for everybody else who travels to it. So I want to talk about it. I want to celebrate it. And so I want some people to watch the PBS documentary tonight so that we'll have some fodder for conversation. All right, friends, thank you for joining me today on Connecting Faith. That's all the time we've got. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.